Welcome to Office Hours, a social science podcast produced at the University of Minnesota, featuring conversations with prominent scholars, researchers, and other movers and shakers in the social world.
This week we talked to Megan Comfort. Megan Comfort is a senior research sociologist in the Urban Health Program at RTI International and an adjunct assistant professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Her work focuses on incarceration, family, intimacy, and public health. The name of Megan's book is Doing Time Together, Love and Family in the Shadow of the Prison, which is published by the University of Chicago Press. The book is the outcome of her ethnographic research at San Quentin Prison, where she studied how intimate relationships are sustained while male partners are incarcerated. Megan, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is a book that is about women who are romantically involved with men who are incarcerated. And I guess to get started, I'm just curious on how you arrived at this topic and what drew you to this.
Well, I actually started working on this topic not as a researcher or an academic. When I first got out of college, I just had a regular job, didn't head straight to grad school. And I started working at the visiting center at California's San Quentin State Prison. So the prisons in California are legally mandated to have a center to help visitors who are coming, providing just some basic services that people need when they come to the prison to visit. And so I started working at the visiting center, providing some of those services, and then also in a health program, providing HIV education for women who were coming to visit prisoners. So I worked at that job for a couple of years and then went from there to grad school in sociology. And so really kind of carried that experience with me when I was thinking about what I wanted to write my dissertation on. And I'll be honest that it actually took still a while for it to dawn on me that this was really the most compelling subject, because I think, like a lot of people, I was really focused on the people who themselves were incarcerated.
Yeah.
So even when I first got the job, I kept thinking a lot of my colleagues were working inside the prison with the men, and I was thinking of this as sort of a stepping stone for myself. So really, it was over the 2 years that I was working there, and then even some into grad school, when I started having a chance to read more of the literature and realizing that there was really nothing written, or very, very little written, on families and loved ones of prisoners.
Was there something that struck you as, I think you kind of frame it as something that's particularly important about these kind of relationships as opposed to the children of incarcerated parents or the mothers of incarcerated sons or...
I would, in general, I think it's very important to be looking at all of these relationships because it's only by considering all of these relationships, and including more casual things like people who go to school together, people who are living in the same neighborhoods, it's only by tracing out all of the consequences of incarceration into these other relationships that we can really understand the magnitude of incarceration. So I wouldn't prioritize one type of relationship over another, but I do think romantic relationships are extremely important, in part because the women that I studied in particular tend to be very, they spend a lot of time interacting with men while they're incarcerated. So it's a relationship that can endure beyond the, you know, once somebody has gone into prison. So there's a lot to be looking at there, whereas some other kinds of relationships might not be as close during the incarceration period. And then I also, the issues affecting children of incarcerated parents are just so important, but I often feel like in that literature we lose sight of the non-incarcerated parent. So a lot of women who are waiting for men who are incarcerated are the mothers of the children of those men. So if we're really going to understand the experience of the children, we need to understand the experiences of the mothers as well.
Your book, your argument sort of builds on what you call these concentric circles. So you really start in the field, what the visiting experience is, and then you kind of walk through the various ways in which women keep in touch, and then you extend your argument into sort of the types of women that emerged. But before we get into that, I'm really curious on what that transition was like for you going from someone who worked there to being a researcher. You know, how was that different for you?
Yeah, it was interesting, and there were multiple things that were happening at once. So I came back to the field. I had had this intense, 2 years of working there, when for anybody who's, worked in service provision before, you're just kind of nonstop, billions of things you're doing every day. So really, really busy and involved. And so it was very different to come back as an observer, really, and not have these roles assigned to me. At the same time, the landscape of the service provision had changed. There had been some programs that went away during the time that I was away, unrelated to my going away.
Okay.
so that meant that there were just fewer people around anyway in those roles, which might have in some ways made things easier, because it was less of a challenge for me not to step into the roles, because there literally weren't the facilities to be providing some of those same services. But then there were a lot of women, as I discuss in the book, who recognized me. I mean, 2 years, I had been away for about 2.5 years when I came back to the field. And, unfortunately for them, a lot of women were either still visiting somebody during the same incarceration, or it was somebody who was kind of going in and out of prison. And so they were back on a subsequent incarceration.
Right.
And those were the trickiest relationships to navigate, because those women associated with me with providing services, doing things like childcare, helping out with things. So I, was really forthright about the changes that had happened, that I was no longer in work capacity. I was there as a student. But at the same time, there were, there are lots and lots of little things, just information people need, or, helping them get a piece of paper or something like that, that were easy ways for me to continue to help people out to some extent. So what I did as sort of a research standpoint was, if there were other people around whom I knew could help the visitors, then I kept in the background and observed, because I wanted to see, well, did they help each other, or what kind of help was forthcoming.
Yeah.
But there were times when it was just me and a visitor, and in those circumstances, I always stepped up and helped people as the best of my capacity, while still, that wasn't primarily why I was there.
So saying, yes, I am a graduate student. I am writing a dissertation.
Right.
And I'm also curious, you kind of have to work in an ethnography, especially at a prison, you have to work through permission at two levels, which is, one, on the level of just your participants and the women you talk to, agreeing to sort of bare their souls and share these intimate details of life with you, but also the prison staff. So maybe we could talk about, any institutional constraints, or how was it getting into the site when you reapproached the facility?
Right. I actually was incredibly fortunate, and I did choose my site in that I was not inside of the prison itself. I was still in an external place where members of the public were allowed to be.
Yeah.
So that, strategically meant that I had more access than I know that people who are trying to do work inside of prisons often have tremendous obstacles to obtain access. So I was really fortunate there, and the same thing that many of the correctional officers who had been working there when I had been there in my prior role also were still there and recognized me. And same thing, I was, honest with them. To be honest, too, like, a lot of people just don't really care. It wasn't like people were necessarily engaging me in conversation or like, hey, good to see you, or anything like that. But if people did ask what I was doing, because they knew that some of these services had been shut down, I would just, I'm in school and I'm here doing my study. So I got permission from the warden of the prison to interview a few correctional officers, just to get some of their perspective on things. So overall, I really had good fortune with the institution.
Yeah, that's very fortunate. It is an interesting position, because it feels, it's at a prison in the sense that, you can, the way you describe it, you can really feel being there and just sort of the kind of landscape of it and the architecture and, but I guess technically you are on the other side of the walls, aren't you?
Right. And that's exactly, my fascination with this area that I was studying, is that it's this liminal space where you really are making that transition. So you are still, technically free. You haven't entered the prison grounds yet, and yet there's so much of the prison that really permeates that space and starts to structure your experiences, even when you are on the outside.
Yeah, and maybe we could talk a little bit, the first chapter kind of the field is on what's called the tube. And so, you know, what is the tube, and what do women and visitors go through in the tube?
Right. So people, both the correctional officers and the visitors, call this area the tube, and it's because it's just a long concrete corridor, really. It has a door on either end, and then it's like a T in the middle. There's a door that leads into what they call the processing area, which mm-hmm. is the first step of going in for a visit into the prison. So once you go through that door, you start to really enter the prison.
Yeah.
And that's where IDs are checked and dress code is verified and all of those kinds of things.
Right.
So the tube is just this kind of waiting zone on the outside. And as I say, it's a long concrete corridor. It has wooden benches, a door on either side. Pretty much the whole time I was up there, the hinges on the doors were broken. So we would, you know, people would prop them open. So it's like really windy in there a lot of the time. And overall, just a very uncomfortable, bare, you know, space. And the issue for women is that they end up spending a ton of time in there because it is where all visitors have to come through in order to enter the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people do that. So there's often a really long line, especially on the weekends or at peak visiting hours. And so that was a huge part of my observations, was watching, you know, what is that experience like for people just to stand in this corridor, to sit on these hard wooden benches, sometimes truly for hours, just to the visit.
And you write, too, that, I mean, even by the time you get there and sit down, you've already gone through this calling in and dealing with this busy line to make an appointment to get in. And then sometimes the women would arrive and the men would be, they'd be encountered by the staff. And that would, so it seems like it was just this really unpredictable wait zone in a way.
Right, exactly. Yeah, as you're describing, I mean, this is my interest in how the prisons seeps out from the institution itself and mm-hmm. into the lives of legally free people. And so some women had to make appointments for their visits, and they call, there's just one dedicated line, and it's just rings busy.
Right.
Women spend, you know, 45 minutes trying to get through. And then they're so anxious, as you can imagine, about that appointment, that people will come 2 hours early for their appointment because they went through so much trouble to get it. They really mm-hmm. don't want to miss it.
Right.
And other times, you know, the things that are going on inside of the prison have an impact. So visiting can be suspended, it can be shut down, it can be, you know, delayed. And so when you're waiting in that corridor, you never really know what's going to happen. And a lot of things happen very, you know, just unexpected things will be announced, or people will be sent home, or you can also, because of security regulations, they don't tell people when they transfer someone from one prison to another.
Oh.
California's a very big state, and so I saw a lot of women who would come up to visit, and it's not until, you know, they've waited for a few hours in the tube and gotten in that somebody tells them, you know, oh, he was shipped out last night, and Ooh. He's 4 hours away from here now.
Right. And I was kind of wondering, I mean, just a few minutes ago when we talked about access, I mean, does that, the stress of the situation, do you think that, I mean, how did that impact your interactions with the women that you eventually interviewed? I mean, was that a barrier, or did it almost, was the interview maybe a relief to some people? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, I would say a lot of times women were very eager to talk. You know,
mm-hmm.
these are people who feel like their experiences and their stories are just not heard or seen. And so my access in terms of interview participants was really easy, because once people knew what I was doing, they really wanted to give me their side of things and have an opportunity to express themselves. In terms of my own negotiation and navigation of how to approach people and when to approach people, I did sometimes, especially if women had been waiting for multiple hours and we'd had a chance to start talking, then they went in and found out, oh, you can't visit today because he's, you know, been sent off to some other prison. Sometimes, you know, they just needed to get out of there. They were so upset and it didn't seem appropriate to bring up an interview. But other times, women came out and they were kind of sticking around and, you know, maybe crying or talking with other women. And then it was something that I could offer them, like, listen, I know that this isn't what you came here for today, but here's an opportunity. And people seem to really welcome that sometimes.
Yeah. No, that's, it's just, it's a really fascinating chapter, because you can really kind of feel the tension in the air that comes with, just sort of having to rely so heavily on an institution that's a, you know, a secure, very high secure unreliable sometimes institutions. So it's really interesting. And the way you kind of set it up is, but women, they still submit them to this over and over. It's something that they come back and do. And you talk about a couple of women who actually, they come every, once a week or twice a week. I mean, were there a lot of people that were just like repeat visitors and they went through this over and over and over?
Yeah, at San Quentin, you really see the full range. So you see people who kind of only managed to make it up there once in somebody's entire incarceration through the women you're describing who were really, really regular, organizing their work schedules and everything around visiting. So there's definitely a strong core of women who make this a priority in their lives and are there on a very regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And then one... not visiting, you talked with the women you interviewed about other ways of keeping in touch. And you went, there's letters and packages, which are a very labor-intensive project, and phone calls, which are very expensive. But I was really curious about this phenomenon that you call presence creation. Can you explain that one?
Sure. Yeah, presence creation was something, it comes up in a lot of different forms, and it is more of an informal thing, which is why I had to give it a name myself.
Yeah.
But it's really the idea of women trying to create someone's presence in one way or another, and sometimes the men are able to reciprocate as well. So one of the clearest examples is San Quentin has an internal television channel, and people know in advance what movies they're going to be showing on SQTV, San mm-hmm. Quentin Television. And so men could find out, they're going to show Rocky IV, on Friday at 7. Mm-hmm. And women could go out and rent that movie and then simultaneously watch it in their own homes while they knew that their partner was watching it in his cell, creating each other's presence. People would do things, try to eat the same foods or at the same time. Or women, several women I knew had, photos that they would bring around with them. I describe in the book a time of eating lunch with somebody, and she puts a photo of her husband on the table with us, now he can eat with us. So this idea of really trying to bring someone into your life, even when he's being kept physically away from you.
Right. That's fascinating. And it's also interesting to think of the ways in which, as you described earlier, that the prison itself kind of seeps into people's personal lives, and it becomes very clear in various parts of the book with food. I mean, food is such a central concept. Why is food so important to these women?
Yeah, food was a great one for me because it wasn't something I had thought that much about beforehand.
Yeah.
So it wasn't one of those, when you're in the field and you get to see things in a different way. And I just noticed over time, people were talking about food all the time. And I think it, comes down, there is amazing literature on the primacy of food and food in terms of family, that a lot of times that's how we show a bond with someone. We prepare food for someone, we share food with someone, we feed people, mm-hmm. Quite literally. And I think that when people are separated in these ways and forced to be apart, something like food, very tangible, very primal, it assumes a huge importance. And mm-hmm. I think also because it was something, unlike so many other things that prisoners do not have access to, food was something, they at least, do eat every day. So at the very minimum, women who wanted to synchronize their meals could do that. But there, food is also, in the context of visiting, there are vending machines, people can eat together. And then in the context of the packages, women were able to send in food. So it was kind of, this element that could be shared and rituals could be built around it, or different ways of incorporating it into a shared existence could be forged by both partners.
Yeah, it's interesting how, and later in the book, you sort of, you start with more of the commonalities, and then you begin to sort of divide the women that you encountered into three kind of broad categories. And you offer kind of these case examples at the beginning of each of those sections. And I thought we could maybe walk through those because they're just such really rich, interesting backgrounds and stories and people that you worked with. And the first group was those women who actually met a man who was already in prison, correct? And then who
right.
had been in prison through their whole relationship.
Right, exactly.
And I think it was Sarah who was the
Right. She was the woman I used. So each section, as you're saying, has sort of a case history of one particular woman who embodied a lot of what I talk about in these categories. And so the categories themselves, as I say in the book, are pretty loosely defined in that we can imagine women sort of moving from one to the other over time. That said, this first one was a little more distinct in that, exactly as you're saying, these were really women who met men once the men were already incarcerated. And for the most part, those were men who were serving life sentences or were on death row at San Quentin. So that women came into the prison sometimes in the capacity of a volunteer in a program, or they were put in touch with somebody by a mutual friend or a mutual relative, and got to know men once the men had already been in prison. And quite often the men had already been incarcerated for several years by the time the women came into their lives.
And there's an interesting connection with some of the women in the situation, and sort of their own background and their own sort of career and politics. I mean, what did you see? What was particular about some of these women?
Right. Well, as I say, the women tended to meet men under circumstances that, as I say, either they were a lot of times coming in for some sort of program-related service in the prison. And so they were women who were already, one, higher resourced women who were able to volunteer their time, or so they were at that level of being able to do that. And then also sort of socially justice minded or organized, you know, participating in organized religion, that brought them to the men. Again, or sometimes people, you know, developed pen pal relationships, again, through sort of a religious affiliation. So a lot of times then the relationship would take on characteristics of those kinds of meetings. So women would really see their relationship with the men as being connected to principles of social justice or connected to sort of religious faith and, you know, people's ability to be redeemed. And so they tended to speak about their relationships a lot in those terms, which made a lot of sense because, as I say, these were often women who had other resources and had what we would think of as, you know, other options available to them. So the fact that they saw some really strong meaning in their relationships makes a lot of sense because that's what connected them to the men and kept them in the relationships.
Yeah, and it was interesting that some of the women, I mean, they really told you that they preferred this situation as compared to, you know, the men that they may have met out that are not incarcerated.
Right. And women express that in different ways for different reasons. But I think there's a lot in the book around, you know, the problematic gender relationships in the outside world and how prison then can mediate some of these. So, there were women who just described, you know, being really disillusioned with men in the outside world and finding that men who were incarcerated, who have a lot of time to think about things, be very reflective, read a lot of books, they really appreciated the what men cultivated in themselves and what that they then brought to the relationship. And a lot of this for women focused on communicativeness and, you know, men who were able to express themselves. I heard over and over these stories, you know, men writing 20-page letters during the visits. If people are there for multiple hours, I mean, there is nothing to do but talk. And women really, really valued this conversation, these communications with men, and felt that contrasted a lot to men on the outside who, you know, haven't been socialized to communicate in these ways, who haven't been in circumstances where they would develop those skills necessarily.
Right, and it's funny you say that. Sometimes this even took on kind of like a feminine descriptive quality, kind of, it's like a prisoner as girlfriend phenomenon in a way.
Right, exactly, yeah. The women, a lot of times, will describe men in ways that sound kind of like your best friend, right? All the way down to some women being very explicit, like, it is like my best friend because we can't even, you know, be sexually intimate.
Right.
We spend all our time talking. It's very interesting with incarceration because we have this image, you know, which in one side is very correct, of it being a very hyper masculine environment. There's a lot of violence, there's a lot of, you know, displays of being tough and being able to take care of yourself physically and all of that. And yet this combined with, one, the time on people's hands, and then two, the men's desire to maintain contact with women on the outside and realizing that the way they're going to do that is by being very communicative.
Right.
They really develop this more feminine side of them, all the way to sometimes, there's one woman who talks about her husband as somebody who does crochet. He learned how to do crochet.
Right.
So it's kind of really
Yeah, you may not have picked that up anywhere else, right?
Exactly.
And that's, and I think you allude to this, where it's, it might almost also be a quality of the types of sentences that these men are serving, because they really, I mean, they're really there for the long haul.
Right. A lot of these men are serving upwards of 15 years, if not a lot longer.
And that's also, I mean, a defining characteristic in the opposite way for these, the other group of men who are sort of in and out of the facility. They, they leave, they come home, and then they go back in and, this is kind of what shapes your second group, which is kind of the standby your man women who just stick through it. And what defined that group for you? What started to emerge as you were talking to people that, that helped you clarify that?
Right. This group of women, I think, is, are the women who are partnered with what we really see when we talk about incarceration in America. So people serving long sentences and who are on death row are, you know, very important members of the carceral population, and we need to be paying attention to them. But they are a relatively small group compared to these larger groups of people who are cycling in and out. You know, and whether that's cycling every 6 months or every couple of years or whatever length sentences they're serving, but people who are going into facilities and coming back home on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And this group of women was really interesting in that they are very kind of politically and socially savvy and astute. And what they often offered were very, you know, sharp and critical discussions of the criminal justice system, of, you know, racism in policing, in, you know, sentencing disparities, in all sorts of reasons why primarily low-income people of color end up behind bars. And what came forth in the analysis then is that that shapes a lot of women's responses to their partner's incarceration. So they're not seeing this as a personal shortcoming of their partner, that he's continually being pulled into the system. They're seeing it in the way sociologists see it.
Yeah.
You know, there are certain policing strategies that are happening. There are certain legal issues that are coming up. And, you know, these men don't really stand a chance to stay out.
Yeah.
And as I say, they had a very astute understanding of a lot of that.
Could you get a sense of where that sort of way of thinking came from? I mean, is it from just experience? I mean, seeing it over and over? Is it from talking to other women? Is it from doing independent reading and research on this? I mean, could you tell where that that point of view emerged?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it could have come from any and all of those. I would say a lot of these women really have been experiencing this very, very personally for a long time. So these are women whose fathers have been incarcerated, whose brothers wound up being incarcerated. You know, they've really seen, and I think, again, that's what helps them see this as not one person's shortcoming. You know, this is happening to 80% of the men I know.
Right.
You know, they have all the stories of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the parole violation for something that really was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether that's, you know, as I say, they've experienced this over time with their relatives, with maybe other men they've been in relationships with. Some of them have now gone on to experiencing it with their sons. And then women sharing those stories among themselves really creates, you know, this understanding that I'm talking about.
Yeah. I was also curious with this group, if your role as a researcher, I mean, how that, did women ever sort of look for affirmation from you because, you know, they assumed that you thought about things in this sociological way as well, or did that not really come up as much?
Well, that's an interesting question. I wouldn't say, yeah, in general, the tenor of the interviews were women, like, you know, wanting to school me and tell me the way things were going. So I wouldn't say I saw too many women who were seeking my own opinion on that.
Right.
I do discuss in the book, there was one woman, it was really interesting to me, where she was talking about her own arrest, and she was saying, you know, I got set up and I don't know, you know, they landed this charge on me, they planted drugs on me or whatever it was. And I had just, it was just when this case was breaking in the Bay Area about the Oakland police, in fact, doing this to people. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, you know, have you seen the papers? Like, you can be part of this lawsuit. You know, there's a civil case moving forward with these folks. And it was interesting to me that she actually was not as, you know, I thought that she would kind of jump on that and want to get the numbers to call up and be a part of. But she was trying to just cope more with the implications it had for her own personal situation, was that she had lost her job over this arrest.
Right, and that's sort of the more immediate concern than the...
Right.
Than pursuing this class action lawsuit. That's
right, exactly.
But what a moment to realize that she was talking about something
that was
really happening at the same time.
Right, exactly.
For the women whose husbands came home, I mean, did you have women that you talked to where their husband would actually come home and you still kept in touch with them?
You know, in this study, I didn't as much because I was really focused on being at San Quentin.
Yeah.
So as I say, we might see people who came back. Yeah. She'd been there for a while and she left and she came back. But in this study, I wasn't really following women when their partners were at home.
Mm-hmm.
Other than one woman we'll probably talk about in a minute in the third group with whom I had a pretty long-term relationship.
Right, yeah. I was just so curious on if... you know, how things must just change so much. And I think some women probably did get into that with you on how their lives were different, and they kind of had to readjust when their partners came home.
Right. And actually, that's the focus of my current research, is we've been working with couples, so with both members of the couple when the men have been released from prison. I don't have the findings and everything from that yet, but it's been really, really interesting, and I'm glad you bring this up because it seemed to me like the logical next step in the research that I've been doing.
Yeah, just so much negotiation, especially when the gender roles are that, you know, the woman is suddenly in charge of, you know, supporting herself and supporting the kids and organizing all these things, and then to have someone come home is just, it can be quite disruptive and very bittersweet probably for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, and what we are finding is to say we're not, you know, through with the study yet, mm-hmm. but you're definitely hearing a lot about these, you know, long-term repercussions of having a criminal record and how men are unable to find work and are really, you know, not able to take a place in the household. And it causes an incredible amount of friction because people on the more emotional side are, you know, they're in love, they're glad to be reunified and want to get on with their lives, and yet it introduces a whole lot of difficulties for people to have another mouth to feed and someone who's unable to contribute financially if he wants to stay out of prison.
Right, and it's just so against our traditional norms of man and breadwinner and all that stuff. And as you said, there's the third category of women, and how would you describe this last group?
So I would say in this group, we really got to the point of women who were very impoverished, who had very few resources. So definitely kind of the opposite of the first group I was talking about before.
Mm-hmm.
And who were so in need of services that, you know, no longer existed or have been massively cut back or for which they weren't considered eligible, that they got into these cycles where the incarceration of their partner could sometimes provide some relief around various problems that were happening. You know, this was a lot linked to men's substance abuse issues that were going untreated you know, when he wasn't incarcerated. Often men who became abusive for one reason or another, men with mental health issues. So these women were unable to find or connect their partners with services, you know, that would be more therapeutic in treatment ways. And so things would escalate to the point that when he was eventually arrested and incarcerated, it provided a bit of relief in the household. But that said, then these are women who, you know, again, they're in love with their partners. And so there was this longing still, because this wasn't the best solution possible.
Right.
Like, now they have to go up and visit him in a prison, which is not something they particularly enjoyed necessarily.
Yeah. And there was a little bit in the second group and also in this group, you kind of saw some evidence that this was also a way to sort of manage some domestic abuse issues.
Right.
And how comfortable were people talking about that with you?
It would vary. And some women, I felt like I was sort of picking up on, you know, people alluding to things but not wanting to speak directly about it, or people who felt more comfortable talking about previous relationships rather than a current relationship. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people were actually quite honest, either about their partner's abusive behavior or sometimes their own violent behavior, which is, you know, something else for us to be taking into consideration.
Yeah, right.
When women, either in self-defense or because of their own substance use or mental health issues, are being violent. So I would say it kind of varied depending on, you know, where.
Right. So there is a woman you write about, Erica, who was, it sounds like you had a pretty strong relationship with her.
Right. I had met Erica actually during my previous work.
Okay.
And we, you know, stayed in touch. And so she was someone who, you know, she was very proactive about being in touch with me and liked to call me up and tell me how things were going. And so I saw her through multiple cycles of her partner's incarceration and release.
Mm-hmm. And she sort of had that whole, you know, sometimes it was a good thing and then other times not a good thing. And it seems like it's a very back and forth. It's so contextual in what's happening in the lives of the women and the way that it plays out.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, her story is really rich. She had a lot to say, and is, again, a lot of her own analytical perspective on what was happening to her. But she had a partner, you know, who definitely had a lot of needs that weren't being met. And he was incarcerated. She was a very resourceful, very resilient woman. So she would manage, when on her own, to, you know, secure pretty steady jobs, get herself a car, you go to her AA meetings and really pull her life together. And then when he came out, he was just a very destabilizing influence, and, you know, he would return to his own substance use pretty quickly, and so he would start selling her possessions and, you know, disrupting the household in various ways. Usually she'd lose the car, which would usually mean she'd lose the job, and things would just really spiral out of control, involving violence then between the two of them. He seemed to be more violent than she, but she acknowledged her own violence in the relationship as well.
Hmm. For women in the third group, I mean, the first group is sort of this, you know, the reformed kind of sensitive ideal partner. That's the draw in a way. And for the women in the second group, it's, you know, this zoomed out sociological, analytical reasoning for why, you know, these patterns of incarceration are happening, or these patterns of reincarceration are happening in their family. Did the women in the third group have sort of an explanatory mechanism like the other two groups? Or was it just sort of the reliance on the system to help them?
Sorry, I lost you a little bit there. But you were asking if the women in the third group had some way of explaining what was going on for them?
Yeah, or just sort of why, you know, beyond just their love for their partner, if there was other reasons that they gave similar to the first two groups on you know, why stick by this guy, or why sustain this relationship?
Right. I would say a couple of things. I mean, in terms of a bigger picture, I think these women were really focused on survival. So they weren't necessarily trying to step back and, you know, give me a big reason for what was going on in their lives. But that said, I mean, I think really across all of the women, and again, this was a study of women who were making the tremendous effort to come to a prison to visit somebody, so it's not surprising this would cross all groups, but, you know, women are just in love with these men. These are, you know, romantic relationships to them. And I think in the, you know, to a large extent in the second group and to a very large extent in the third group, there is also this, you know, social fact that women don't necessarily have a lot of choice to be involved with men who aren't going in and out of prison.
Right.
So it was kind of, you know, in Erica's case, for example, she did have other suitors and other men who wanted to be involved with her, but she was like, you know, I've been with this man for a long time. I know, you know, I know his patterns. We know each other. So kind of, I'd rather stick with somebody I'm actually in love with and with whom I have a long history and where I sort of know the deal with him, as opposed to trying with somebody else who could be very unpredictable and you know, who also is likely going in and out of prison. You know, why kind of shift to that when I actually love this man that I'm with?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that before, but length of relationship, I mean, must have been a pretty important factor for making the decision to drive up to the prison and to wait in the tube and do this whole thing. I mean, were most of the women that made this effort in very long-term relationships, or was that kind of all over the board too?
It actually was all over the board, but you could see sort of where people, so those you're saying, the ones that had been long relationships, we can kind of understand more immediately why women are staying in relationships. Women who maybe were much more new in a relationship often would have a story of, you know, I saw my mom do this for my dad. Like, you know, I just met this guy, you know, we've only been together a couple months, but I really, really love him. And, you know, this is what you do to, like, build family, right? Mm-hmm. Or to build a relationship. Mm-hmm. So there were stories kind of, you know, like that around why women would make that effort. So it was, in terms of timing, it was sort of all over the place, but women did have, you know, reasons that held together.
Right.
There wasn't so much, you know, just a casual, like, oh, I'll just come up.
Right.
Because I have nothing else to do.
It's not an ideal way to spend a day until you actually get into the visiting room. That's
the thing, exactly, like the waiting and all of that. But I'm glad you bring that up because we didn't discuss that before. And that's part of this whole story in terms of, you know, the poverty that women are coming from and the needs that they have that aren't getting met. Is I did have a surprising number of women talking about the visiting itself as a pleasurable experience. And some of that, again, is just being able to be with the person you love and in an environment where you can talk and enjoy each other's company. But some of it came through pretty explicitly around, you know, being able to be in a safe environment, being able to be in an environment that felt better than the impoverished environments that women were living in. And so that stood out for me as a very stark finding that, you know, we have people who are living in neighborhoods and housing that is so abominable that spending a day in a prison and sometimes nights in prison because the women who were legally married could have overnight visits, women would talk about that in very favorable terms.
Yeah, that was so interesting to me. They almost have these little, are they almost like little apartments or bungalows where entire families can actually spend a day or two together. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So California has, they call it family visiting because it's not just for couples. It can be for nuclear family members, so like mothers could go in and stay with their sons. Mm. And so they have these little housing units that are kind of like trailers, and it varies from prison to prison, you know, what those situations are like. But so people from the outside can come in and you have to jump through a whole bunch of, you know, security clearances, and the person you're visiting has to not have a whole bunch of different security classifications. So when it comes down to it, it's a relatively small number of people who are eligible for these visits, but for who have them, they're really, really meaningful. And yeah, they come in and they're actually two-night visits. So people come in one day and spend a full two nights and leave on the third day.
And it becomes this very almost like a vacation in a way, very idealized, very perfect situation for some women. I mean, they get so much out of it.
Right. And again, you know, taking us right back to what I was just saying about what does this mean about our society
that this is better.
Exactly. And women did talk about that in terms of, you know, safety and, you know, not being afraid, not having a lot of drama going on. One woman talks about it being quiet because her home neighborhood is just always so loud with people screaming and the violence going on. So, you know, for her, spending two nights when it was peaceful and quiet, as she said, she slept well. And
And there's just a stability there that people mm-hmm. don't have at home.
Right. And again, the men, you know, they're talking, they're communicative. In this case, then you get the physical intimacy as well, which is really, really meaningful for people.
Right.
But men who are substance addicted or men who might be violent, you know, those kinds of things have been managed, mm-hmm. managed punitively, but managed.
Right.
So that people can spend some time together.
That also, when I was reading the book, and I'm glad that your current project is addressing just this, because I wondered how hard that transition would be to have these very you know, almost romanticized memories of these beautiful, quiet, stable weekends at the prison, and then how that might contrast to, you know, how things play out in the free world when men do come home and you don't get that reserved space and time and.
Right.
And,
exactly.
And that'll be really interesting for you to dig into. You close the book with just some ideas, you know, some things that you can really see as interesting areas to go. And you outline three, which is women's roles in sort of the institutional management of prisoners, plea bargaining, and then women as secondary parole officers. And we don't have to go into deep detail on those, but I thought the institutional management piece was really interesting because there is a behavioral incentive for men on the inside, correct, to get visitors.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, there's just the pure, you know, wanting to be with people and to see the people you love. Then there's also the, you know, breaking up of the boredom and having something to do when you have visitors. Mm-hmm. But you're only permitted to have visitors come in if you haven't had, you know, behavioral infractions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of motivation for people who want their visitors to come in to, you know, stay out of trouble and watch themselves.
Right.
And so, yeah, so you have this way that women are contributing to, you know, keeping men in line while they're incarcerated. And that's something that I think, you know, we just haven't paid enough attention to is the burden that's falling on, you know, outsiders in general. But really, it's almost always women who are supporting men who are inside, whether it's supporting them emotionally or financially or both. But all the burden that falls on them as
right.
institutions pare back, as they offer fewer services, you know, every time they make a cut for what prisoners are given, it doesn't necessarily mean that people aren't getting that anymore. It's meaning that women on the outside are paying for it now.
Yeah, that's actually a very good point. And it also overlaps with this idea of women as kind of secondary parole officers or corrections officers, where they even continue to carry that burden maybe when the man is released.
Right.
And they become part of that almost surveillance process. And that's, you know, not something you would typically find in a relationship.
Right. Yeah, I mean, women are put in these really difficult positions where, you know, they want the man to do well, they want him to succeed, they want him to get a job, they often will also assume just a lot of these responsibilities before men are released because the men can't do things from inside, like make phone calls and all that kind of thing you might want to do to get yourself ready to be out in the free world again.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of work and labor that women put into this. And then they're in, as they say, this difficult position in that they understand the men well, and they know that. They see themselves that way. So they're kind of in this quasi-social work. You know, I know why he does the things he does. I know why he returns to drugs. I know why he returns to the streets, but I don't want him to. And,
yeah.
you know, they're really tugged in a whole lot of directions. And so that some different times they might even seem to be conflicting in their roles because they're trying to support him, but they're also like calling the parole officer and saying, you know, I want you to drug test him more because that's the only way he's going to stay clean, or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and it's this sort of this incredible sense of power that is afforded to these women that almost extends the way that the men are disciplined in a way. I mean, having this other level of kind of control over their lives where there's a person, you know, people in relationships that get in fights and a woman really could, you know, call a corrections officer, a parole officer, and there could be some serious repercussions for the man. So it's just kind of fascinating to think of how that really affects the dynamics of the relationship itself.
Right. And what you're talking about really connects to this idea that I use of sociological ambivalence
right.
in the book, which is a concept that Robert Merton and Eleanor Barber developed. And I just think, you know, including in the work I'm doing now, it just comes through so clearly in the way women are experiencing their relationships and all of this penal management. So on the one side, they're grateful for having, you know, some more power, especially with men who maybe have been abusive or who have some really serious problems. On the other hand, they resent being put in that position.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of, say, a lot of burden, a lot of work. It's really exhausting. Then they feel bad about it because they do love these men. And when men go back into prison, they often, you know, are really sorrowful around that. So this idea that, that women are just through this, the structures of the criminal justice system pulled in all these different directions, they just, you know, the profound ambivalence that comes through and what they have to say about it.
Yeah. And then also you really connect that to this idea of secondary prisonization. And maybe we can close just explain to our, you know, our listeners what that concept is, what prisonization is, and then how it's augmented for these women.
Right. Yeah, actually, this is, I'm glad to close on this because it kind of really summarizes the gist of all of this research mm-hmm. and what I'm trying to work on now. So prisonization, as a lot of your listeners will know, comes from Donald Clemmer in The Prison Community, which was written way back in 1940. And he was really the one to put forward this concept that being incarcerated transforms people. It's a, you go through processes of learning how to be an incarcerated person, and you take on, you know, different ways of dressing and of behaving and of talking, and it really profoundly transforms who you are.
Yeah.
So I realized as I was moving forward in the fieldwork and the analysis, really where you and I started this conversation, you know, the prison is seeping out of its boundaries and in entering women's homes. Women are entering the prison and spending all of this time in there. And so over the course of the time that their men are behind bars, women are really being transformed by the correctional institution itself. And so I call that secondary prisonization. So we can see all these different ways that women also change, you know, the way they talk, the way they behave, the way they dress.
Yeah.
I was speaking before about the dress code. You know, it really, I was speaking to before, you know, when we talk about women changing or, you know, synchronizing their meals with when their partners are eating, watching certain movies, like all of that is a transformation of women's selves based on the incarceration of their partner or secondary prisonization.
And do you think that's something that, do you think for many women that's just it just ties to that ambivalence that this is just sort of part of the deal and this is kind of it's the way it is and it's more of an acceptance of that than a resistance?
Again, it can go through the spectrum. I think there are some women who are very aware of these kinds of transformations. And within those women, there are people who, you know, just hate it and reject it as much as possible, and other women who embrace it and say, this is, you know, like we were talking about with the presence creation, and, you know, this is just what I want to do to support my partner and to be with him as much as possible, to do this time with him. Then there are other women, and again, I think these are women we see who are you know, have really grown up in the criminal justice system, even if they have never been arrested or incarcerated, where it's much more subtle for them, you know. But so weekends mean going to visit people in prison, or all these different ways that the carceral world has taken over their world, socially, domestically, that they don't, you know, maybe they don't even necessarily recognize because they haven't had a chance to know something else.
Yeah.
So I think those women aren't necessarily resisting or accepting. It's just, you know, really it's something that has infused their daily existence.
Yeah. So, but, you know, if we're thinking in terms of implications or the impact that a book like this has, you know, what were your goals and how was that leading you into your current project and your next project?
I would say there are kind of two levels. I mean, one, having spent the time I did both as a service provider and then as a researcher with these women, you know, one of my primary goals was just to get their experiences out there, mm-hmm. And, you know, to bring our attention to what they were going through. And I, you know, I've had a chance to stay in touch with a lot of women. I gave women copies of the book, and that's felt really good. You know, I think I also always feel really, really happy when I get contacted by women who have incarcerated partners whom I didn't study but who have come across the book and write to me. And mm-hmm. So that just feels really rewarding, and I think that there was, you know, the aim of just making these stories known, these experiences. But then on a more analytical level, there's, you know, the idea that guides is this, all of my work, including what I'm doing now, that that I was speaking of before around we really need to be looking beyond the one incarcerated individual in order to understand the repercussions of incarceration in our society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, encouraging all of us to be thinking, you know, and hopefully eventually encouraging policymakers and people who can really be directing these things. You know, when we talk about what's happening to one person, sending one person behind bars for X amount of time, you know, what does that really mean to that person's partner, to that person's family, mm-hmm. to that person's neighborhood? So, you know, my hope is to be contributing to this body of work that happily is growing, and there's some really good work being done out there, looking at, you know, the full spectrum of incarceration as it affects people in all, you know, at all levels, whether they are the targets of the criminal justice intervention or not.
Right, just sort of the shadow it casts over everything.
Right, right, exactly. And yeah, I mean, and we need to push ourselves to go pretty far beyond. I mean, so I'm looking at women who are, you know, in relationships with an incarcerated person, which is actually still quite a close relationship. Yeah. But then, again, I was speaking earlier before about schools. You know, there are children who they have not been arrested. Their parents haven't necessarily been arrested, but they're in schools with, you know, 70% of the kids who have been traumatized by this experience.
Right.
And so it's going to affect them as well and, right. and their educational experience. So really trying to take the gaze as far out as possible to see what does this really mean when we're talking about these kinds of incarceration policies.
Well, thank you so much for your willingness to share how this book came to be and came together. I really enjoyed reading it.
No, thank you.